left off talking about audition, sense of hearing, and previous slide, slide 23, was about the amplification that the auditory ossicles achieve. And why is it amplification? What is reduced? The surface area. The oval window has a much smaller surface area than the tympanic membrane, and therefore the pressure of the pressure wave is increased. That's important because on the other side, the medial side of the oval window, is liquid rather than gas, and that's a lot more dense and therefore harder to push on. What you see in slide 23 is the cochlea itself up in the upper left. That is that's the organ of hearing. The ear is really a dual organ. It's an organ of hearing, that's one special sense, and of balance, another special sense. The part that deals with audition, though, or hearing, is the cochlea. Anyone know what cochlea means? What would you guess by looking at it? Snail, right. Looks pretty much like certain snails. And this is a hollow structure, a coiled hollow structure, but the hollowness is filled with, as I said, liquid. And you see a cutaway view right below the where it's labeled cochlea, and then an even closer view of where just one part of that coil is being cut into. And finally then, that inset in the center of the screen is really being looked at close up at the bottom of the screen. And this is really the business end of the cochlea as far as physiology is concerned, as far as transduction of pressure waves that are set up in the fluid within the cochlea duct, transducing those pressure waves, which is mechanical energy, into the electrical energy of a action potential, which is then sent to the brain and results in perception once it's in the higher centers in the cerebral cortex. So what you see on the bottom here is that there is a population of cells, several supporting cells shown in azure, these azure colored ones, that are built on what is called the basilar membrane. The basilar membrane is within the lumen of this overall cochlea. The outer walls of the cochlea, so the surface of the snail, those are butted right up against bone, which is important because bone doesn't give. It's solid. Okay, so even though the surface of the cochlea is membranous and therefore would be pliable, it's not allowed to be pliable because it's right up against bone. Whereas this basilar membrane, which is inside the lumen of the tube, is a pliable structure. It's like a drum skin, basically. It's able to move back and forth. And built on top of this basilar membrane are these supporting cells, the bluish ones, and then the pinkish hair cells. The hair cells are the receptor cells for audition. And they're called hair cells because if you look at them very close up, you see that each hair cell has elaborations in its plasma membrane, which are called stereocilia. They're little hair-like projections. That's why they're called hair cells. But they're actually just part of the plasma membrane, and they house mechanoreceptors. Mechanoreceptors, in general, remember, respond to mechanical stimuli by changing the conductance of a plasma membrane to some sort of ion in response to some sort of deformation. So when they get pressed or pulled, they open up ion channels, and therefore that causes a change in the membrane potential of the cell that houses those mechanoreceptors, in this case the hair cells. So since this is a sensory receptor, it wouldn't make sense, of course, to have the ion channels that are opened be for something that's going to cause a hyperpolarization, right? That would just keep action potentials from ever reaching the brain, and they're not sending to the brain anyway before there's a disturbance. So sensory receptors need to depolarize in general. That's the only way that they can cause a depolarization in the neuron that the receptor cell is associated with. And that's true here for audition. These pink hair cells have their stereocilia, those hair-like structures, projecting upward from them, upward in this view, of course. Upward doesn't really make any sense, but they are brought into proximity, into closeness with this tectorial membrane. Tectorial means roof-like, forming a roof. And the tectorial membrane is also inside the lumen of the cochlear duct. But it, unlike the basilar membrane, is fairly rigid. And so it doesn't move back and forth very easily, whereas the basilar membrane will if it's pushed on. Okay? So the way transduction of sound pressure waves into electrical action potentials works is that whatever the disturbance in the environment is causes some object to move back and forth, like the desk when I hit it the last time. That causes the pressure wave in the air. That pressure wave, by neighboring molecules pushing on each other on the way from the disturbance to your ear, reaches the tympanic membrane. That pushes on the tympanic membrane, moves it back and forth since it's drum-like. That then in turn moves the auditory ossicles, the malleus, incus, and stapes. The stapes is connected to the oval window, so that causes the oval window to move back and forth or in and out, but at a greater amplitude because of the amplification, since the oval window is less surface area than the tympanic membrane. That increased amplitude then is enough to push on the comparatively dense liquid inside the cochlea, and that sets up a pressure wave within the liquid. That pressure wave travels through the lumen of the cochlea, pressing on all the surfaces as it goes, just like any pressure wave would in a container. And this is why it's important that the surface of the cochlea is butted up against hard bone, because otherwise the surface of the cochlea would just balloon out in response to this pressure wave, and the information would be lost. Okay? So that's why the cochlea is embedded in bone, and that pressure wave then is allowed to travel through the along the length of the coiled cochlea. And one thing that it pushes on and that is able to give in response to that pushing is the basilar membrane. So the pressure wave pushes on the basilar membrane and gets it moving up and down with respect to this, how it's in this picture. And since all these cells are lying on top of the basilar membrane, when the basilar membrane moves up and down, the cells move up and down. And if it moves up and down enough, which would be in response to a sufficiently high amplitude pressure wave, then the stereocilia of that of those hair cells get forced up into this comparatively rigid roof-like tectorial membrane. And that causes the stereocilia to bend. That bending is deformation. That's what triggers the mechanoreceptors to open up channels that allow for depolarization of the hair cell. Okay? So ions flow through the membrane, depolarizing the hair cell. That is the receptor potential in this specific case. And that receptor potential then activates the neuron. The receptor potential depolarizes the hair cells enough so that they release a neurotransmitter that it then depolarizes the neuron to which the hair cells are attached. And if there's enough neurotransmitter in response to a great enough depolarization of the hair cell, then there's going to be achievement of threshold in the neuron, in which case, as usual, you'll get an automatic action potential that travels along the length of that neuron. Well, that neuron starts there in the cochlea and travels as a bundle of neurons called the vestibulocochlear nerve to the brain. And once the brain learns about it, then it creates the sensation of hearing. Remember that all of your sensations occur in your brain. You get punched in the face. It feels like that's occurring at the face. It's really in the brain. Orgasm is in the brain. All of your sensations occur in the brain, but they start, the stimuli occur elsewhere. Okay, so that's basically how the transduction process works. Figure slide 24 shows this in a little greater detail. Shows the hair cell at rest, not releasing much neurotransmitter. When it gets deformed, though, more is going to be released in response to the depolarization of the hair cell. In other words, in response to the receptor potential. And so the more that these hair cells are deformed, the more the depolarization, and therefore the greater the frequency of the action potentials that are created in the neuron. So it's the same general scheme. The nervous system encodes strength of stimulus as increase in frequency of action potentials. Well, that explains how you can get from mechanical pressure wave to an electrical action potential. But it doesn't get at how we are able to tell the difference between certain qualities of sound. And that's a very complicated thing that we could spend a semester on. But there's two really important qualities of sound I want to talk about. And that is amplitude, which is the loudness. We need to be able to tell the difference between a loud sound and a soft sound, or a loud note and a soft note. And the other is pitch, or frequency. We can tell the difference between a high note and a low note. How we deal with those two things in the ear is different. What you see in 25 is the basilar membrane in cartoon form here. This is a cochlea that has been desnailed. It's uncoiled into a straight line. And the basilar membrane is the blue piece. Well, notice that when you look at just the basilar membrane at the top, that it is not a consistent structure along its length. It goes from being relatively thick and narrow to being relatively thin and wide at the other end. And that's important because of the notion of resonance. Can someone tell me what resonance is? Every object has a resonant frequency. That's the frequency at which it, in a sense, if you let me anthropomorphize, wants to vibrate. It wants to oscillate at a certain frequency based on what it's made of and what the dimensions of those things that it's made of are. So for instance, this is how, well, any instrument, but it's easiest to illustrate with a stringed instrument, whether it's a piano, a harp, a viola, whatever. You know that different strings produce different notes, or in other words, different frequencies. That's because the strings vibrate on their own at different frequencies. That frequency is determined partially by what the string is made out of, how dense it is, how tightly it is stretched, and how big it is. For instance, if you look at a bass, a stand-up bass, it has very big strings, right? Very wide strings and long. But the string, in a sense, knows to make that note regardless of how you pluck it or bow it. In other words, all you have to do is disturb it and let it vibrate, and it's going to vibrate at a certain frequency that is a property of itself. That is called its resonant frequency. Another example would be a backyard swing, which is really just a familiar example of a pendulum. A swing will, if you disturb it, if you lift it and let go, it's going to swing back and forth at its resonant frequency. Doesn't matter if you push it harder or with less force, it's still going to take the same amount of time to get from one extent to the other, which is called its period. The amount of time that it takes to get from one extent to the other is its period. That period is independent of the disturbance. If If you push harder, it'll go up in the air. It'll have a bigger swing. But maybe surprisingly to some of you, it will still take the same amount of time. If you just barely push it, it's going to barely move, but it's going to be moving slower, so it's going to take the same amount of time for the period. If you change something about the swing, though, like taking a few links out of the chain, making it shorter, or putting a kid on it, it's going to resonate at a different frequency. Okay, does that make sense? Well, basilar membrane changes its characteristics along the length. It's not like a guitar string that's consistent along its length. It goes from being thick and narrow to thin and wide. And therefore, it's kind of like a drum skin. If you imagine a drum that is triangular, shaped like the basilar membrane, rather than just having a round drum head, it's a triangular head that's wide on one end and narrow on the other. You can just imagine that beating that on the wide end is going to produce a lower note, right? And where the narrow end is going to produce a higher note. And that's because the individual slices, if you think of it as little slices of drum skin, are going to have different resonant frequencies because of the different properties of the dimensions. Similarly for the basilar membrane, the proximal end, which is the thick and narrow end, has a high resonant frequency. The other end has a low resonant frequency. Well, the other important thing about the resonant frequency is that to use the string analogy again, I mean the swing analogy again, things want to resonate. They want to vibrate at their resonant frequency rather than some other frequency. You can try to get them to vibrate at other frequencies. So on the swing one, for instance, if you are looking at a swing and you push it each time it comes back to you, you can tell exactly when to push to make it get a little higher each time. You're causing it to resonate because you are giving a disturbance that is of the same frequency as the resonant frequency. If, on the other hand, you try to do that blindfolded, or if you just intentionally do it at some other frequency, sometimes you'll be pushing when the swing's not even there. That's not going to do anything. Other times you're going to be pushing right when it gets back, and it's going to stop the swing. So it's going to keep it from really vibrating wildly, whereas if you give it just the right frequency, it's going to make it swing more and more, which is what you do with your legs when you want to go higher and higher. You're causing a disturbance that is at exactly the right frequency for that swing. Well, if you disturb the basilar membrane with a frequency, all parts along the length of that basilar membrane are going to be disturbed at the same frequency. But there's only going to be one part along the length of the basilar membrane that wants to vibrate at that frequency, because that's going to be its resonant frequency. Okay? So this pressure wave that's set up in the cochlear fluid is going to push on all parts of the basilar membrane, causing them to vibrate at that frequency at least a little. But there's at the one place along the length where that is the resonant frequency for that part of the basilar membrane, that piece of the basilar membrane is really going to vibrate back and forth with a much greater amplitude. It's going to resonate, in other words. And that means that only one section of the basilar membrane is going to move enough to get its hair cells jammed up against the tectorial membrane. You have hair cells associated with the entire length of the basilar membrane. If just one little section of those hair cells gets resonated and pushed and activated, then that means only one certain population of neurons are going to fire. And the brain knows where all of these individual neurons are situated along the length of the basilar membrane. So when the brain hears about it, it says, well, these neurons are firing. This must be a 14 kilohertz signal. Whereas if the neurons that are farther toward the distal end, the thin and wide end, the brain's going to say that must have been a lower frequency stimulus. I'm going to create the sensation of a lower note. And that's how pitch is discerned. amplitude or loudness is much more straightforward. That's simply a matter of a loud stim. I mean, a large stimulus in the environment is going to cause whatever is moving in the environment to move with greater amplitude. That's simply going to create a bigger pressure wave in the air. It's going to push on the tympanic membrane harder. That's going to push on the oval window harder. That's going to push on the cochlear fluid harder. And that's going to push on the basilar membrane harder. So it's going to jam those stereocilia even harder up into the tectorial membrane and cause a greater frequency of action potentials at that particular place. And so the brain says, not only is this part of the basilar membrane being disturbed, which is what gives you the pitch, but it's really being jammed up in there because I'm getting a high frequency of action potential. So I'm going to make it this note, and I'm going to make it seem very loud. Okay? Is that clear? Well, of course, you have two ears, and therefore you have two cochlea, cochlei, I guess is the plural. And slide 26 just really shows you that, as in the case of optical information about vision, auditory information is a mixture of the two sides. There is crossing over of some information and not crossing over of other information, so that the overall perception is a blend of the two. Kind of like the sensory analog of stereophonic reproduction of music, which would be like, that would be motor information, whereas we're microphones basically versus loudspeakers, but they're really the same devices. They both transduce energy. Anyway, there's just a mixture in the brain, and the brain sorts it all out, figures out where the sound is coming from, and how loud it is, and what pitch it is. Among other things, of course, is pitch and loudness are not the only two qualities of sound. You have timbre, texture, those are all beyond the scope of this course. But it's a pretty neato device. The other important part of the ear, as far as special senses are concerned, is the vestibule. The cochlea is for hearing. The vestibule is for balance or equilibrium. And that's why the one nerve, the one cranial nerve for each ear that deals with both of these special senses is called the vestibulocochlear nerve. The vestibular part of that is for balance, the cochlear part is for audition. And balance works very similarly to audition. It uses hair cells, just like audition does, and it's based on mechanoreceptors, just like audition is. But the apparatus is housed in a different part. Now, the two are connected, though. The cochlea, you see in slide 27 here, is connected to the rest of the stuff that actually also kind of looks snail-like. The vestibule is more or less a bag that is connected to the cochlea, and attached to the vestibule are three semicircular canals, so named because each of them is a half of a circle. And the three semicircular canals are also mutually orthogonal, which simply means that each one is at right angles to the other two. So they correspond to the three Cartesian planes, or the three planes of dissection, if you want to think of it anatomically. There's an X plane, a Y plane, and a Z plane, for instance, all at right angles to each other, right? Like this. And so if you think of the three Cartesian planes, the X, Y, and Z planes in a three-dimensional plot, any point in space can be defined as three coordinates, right? An x-coordinate, a y-coordinate, and a z-coordinate. So each place in space is uniquely defined by those three coordinates. And That's why you have three semicircular canals that correspond to these planes, because movement of the fluid within these canals is going to differ from canal to canal, depending on what kind of movement you have. All right. More about that in a minute, but first let me differentiate between two kinds of balance. There is static balance. Static, of course, means not changing or not moving. And there's dynamic balance, which does mean moving or changing. So you need to be able to balance yourself, whether you're just standing there in a certain position or whether you're moving your head around. And the vestibule itself, which includes the utricle and saccule, as you see here, that is specifically for static balance, whereas the semicircular canals are for dynamic balance. Okay? Well, the utricle and saccule I'm mentioning as parts of the vestibule just because they are situated at right angles to each other also. And if you look at the maculae, which are really the business end of this, of the utricle and saccule. So there's a utricular macula and there's a saccular macula. But if you look at a macula, what you see is that it includes some supporting cells, shown in salmon here, and these hair cells, which look exactly like the hair cells in the cochlea, are scattered here and there within the supporting cells. They have stereocilia just like the cochlear hair cells, but there's no tectorial membrane here, and the cells themselves in this case aren't moving. They just stay put. Another difference is that unlike the cochlea, in the maculae, you have this gelatinous mass, this jelly-like fluid that includes a bunch of rocks, a bunch of tiny little rocks, ear rocks, or ear stones, which are called otoliths, which means ear stones. That increases the density of this whole mass of gelatin, but the gelatin part of it makes it able to flow. I guess ooze is the better word, because it's not flowing quickly. But if you tip the surface that it's resting on enough, it will ooze across the surface. And when it does, it bends the stereocilia of these hair cells. And since each hair cell is associated with its own neuron, which of these hair cells is being oozed across, the brain can know about. And since the macula in the utricle is at right angles to the macula in the saccule, depending on which position your head is in, the gelatinous mass in one macula is going to ooze faster than in the other one, and in a certain direction as well. And so not only which hair cells are being fired tells the brain partially what direction your head is, but also how what the order of the firing of the hair cells is tells you which way you just recently tilted your head, because this thing is going to ooze across the hair cells. These hair cells are going to be bent first, then this one. The brain keeps track of that and makes the calculation. If it's oozing this way, the head must be tilted that way. And so the response to that, the homeostatic response, is to fire the correct neurons to activate the correct skeletal muscles to keep your head or to maintain your posture. Not just your head, also other body muscles, skeletal muscles. But that's static balance, because that's just basically maintaining a posture. When you're moving around, then the semicircular canals are more important. They're filled with fluid. They have, as you see in part C, structures that are, each structure is called a cupula, plural is cupulae, that include hair cells, but the cupula is connective tissue that is permanently attached to these hair cells. And it's a pliable structure, but the cupula is in the lumen of the semicircular canals at the base, And so it's surrounded by the fluid. So what moves in the semicircular canals in response to your head moving around is the fluid. But as that fluid swishes through the tube, it will bend the cupula one way or the other, and to a certain degree. Well, if you're moving your head in one direction, it can be any direction, but that direction corresponds to a unique combination of X, Y, and Z coordinates. In other words, anatomically, the fluid in one semicircular canal is going to move more briskly if you're moving your head in that plane than the fluid in the other canals is going to move, right? So each of the cupulae are going to be moved to a certain extent when you're moving your head, but if you're moving your head in this direction and you're shaking your head no, that's going to move the fluid in the horizontally placed canal the most. And so those specific cupulae send a much greater frequency of action potentials to the brain, and the brain says, this is the X, this is the Y, this is the Z, therefore the head is moving in this direction. It makes that calculation fairly quickly, of course, allowing you to maintain posture. But that's why you can get dizzy if you if you spin yourself in a chair, as kids are wont to do, then that really is fooling the brain into thinking gravity is pointed in the wrong direction, because if you keep spinning, things come to equilibrium, and it's just like things are being pressed against the side of the... It's causing the vestibule to think... I mean, it's causing the vestibule to fire in a way that makes your brain think you're on your side, lying on your side, which is what gravity would have the same effect of doing. And therefore, it fires the muscles responsible for maintaining that posture, which is not appropriate when you're trying to stand up and you fall over. Yeah. Yes, it can. Something's happening with this chain of events somehow. It can be wrong with anything in. It could be a structural reason right at the cupula, or it could be something wrong with the neurons along the way. Something could be interfering with the neurons. Anything could go wrong. But that's a good question. Yeah. You mean when you feel dizzy because of being drunk? I don't know exactly how that... I mean, it's not because of stuff that's happening in the ear. It's because of neural misfiring or neural interference. But I'm not exactly sure what the physiological basis of it is based on ethanol. I'd have to check on that. Yeah. Well, the vestibule, that's a good question, because proprioception is definitely involved here. And signals from the vestibule are routed to the cerebellum, and specifically a part of the cerebellum that's called the vestibulocerebellum. And that is an important integrating center, which then sends information to the cerebrum. It has to eventually go to the cerebrum, because then the cerebrum is where it finally sends impulses through neurons to correct skeletal muscles. But the cerebellum is a major comparator. It acts as a comparator. A comparator is a device that compares two values. If the difference in the two values is high enough, that's an error signal, then steps need to be taken to undo that error, which is what negative feedback is. Well, the cerebellum is highly involved in that. And it hears all, I mean, it gets all of these signals from the vestibule before it sends it to the cerebrum. Yeah?
This is actually from a couple slides ago, but as you get older and your hearing starts to deteriorate...
Excuse me? No, it's just a little joke. Well, things stiffen up, for one thing. Materials stiffen up, just like skin does. That's part of it. But also, you lose nerves. Well, you lose neurons as you age. In fact, you lose them in kind of astonishing numbers, which is why you really only, when audition is listed as for humans being from 20 hertz to 20,000 hertz, that's really only for like an 18-year-old. And even if you take care of your ears, that rapidly declines, especially at the higher frequencies. And more so in men, for some reason, I don't know. But by the time you're my age, you've lost many of those high frequencies simply because of neuron damage. And it's not, musically, it's not a huge deal because there's not a lot of musical information up there. But I don't know what about, other than nerve damage, I don't know why people who can still hear pitches just need to have a much greater amplitude stimulus to get it processed, other than stiffening, but that's, I'm sure that's not all of it. Does anyone know what else goes wrong? I guess not. Yeah. Well, I don't think there's one cause of tinnitus. That can be purely neural phenomenon as well. What are you saying is one cause?
The loud noise, like a high amount of pressure, causes the hair-like fibers to break, and so now you just have a constant.
Oh, so in other words, they allow for constant depolarization, even without a stimulus there. That makes sense. That makes sense. I don't know, though, why it's preferentially for high frequencies. Unless it's simply because since those are the proximally placed receptors, they get the brunt of the damage because that's right where the pressure wave is applied. Well, I don't know that they would be smaller cells. That they're on a smaller part of the basilar membrane. But the hair cells themselves are probably the same size. Yeah. Yeah, I'm actually glad you said this because this is exactly why the high frequency end of the basilar membrane is the proximal part, which is where the oval window is situated, and the low frequency is at the very end of the cochlea. And that's because high frequency sounds, high frequency pressure waves dissipate a lot more quickly in the environment. They die out with distance a lot sooner than low frequency sounds do, and that's true in the environment of the base of the cochlea as well. So a high frequency pressure wave wouldn't have enough energy by the time it gets to the end, if that's where the high frequency part of the basilar membrane were situated, wouldn't have enough energy to actually cause depolarization of the hair cells. But low frequency pressure waves do make it all the way through the cochlea and have enough energy to resonate that part of the basilar membrane. This is also why elephants, for instance, have very low note sounds that they make. Those low notes travel over very long distances. Whales, the same thing. Go ahead. How do what plants? Implants? Oh, cochlear implants are actually just an artificial transduction device. I don't know exactly how it transduces the pressure wave into electricity, but that's all it's doing. And then that, once you have an electrical stimulus, it actually directly stimulates neurons. Now the resolution is lost, of course, because they don't have an electrode for every neuron. But they're basically trying to do the job of a healthy cochlea by taking a shortcut, by cutting something out of the system. Anything else? Okay. Slide 28 describes the action of the cupulae in the semicircular canals by analogy with a paintbrush. But I think you can pretty much straightforward understand the cupulae without even the analogy. The endolymph, by the way, that's just the name for the fluid that's in the semicircular canals. So they get brushed one way or the other, but depending on how quickly you're moving your head and in which direction you're moving it in, that endolymph is going to cause deformation to a lesser or a greater degree. And of course, the more the cupula is bent, the more depolarization there is in the hair cells, and therefore the more neurotransmitters released onto the neuron, and therefore the higher the frequency of action potentials that are created in the neuron. And that information travels through the vestibular tributary of the vestibulocochlear duct. It's a tributary, not a branch, because these are sensory neurons sending information to the brain. They converge, they don't diverge. Uh, 29 is a good illustration of how the maculae work within the vestibule. This is static balance. If you just tilt your head but then maintain it in that tilted direction, then this gelatinous mass is going to ooze across the surface. And that's going to happen to a greater degree in either the utricle or the saccule, depending on which way your head is tilted, and the brain figures it out. Slide 30 is kind of what I was saying to the question about proprioception. Notice that this information from through the vestibulocochlear nerve, the balance information is coming from the vestibular branch. Well, it shouldn't be a branch, it's a tributary. Anyway, it goes to the cerebellum. Cerebellum deals with it, integrates it as a comparator does, and that's important in the cerebellum. I mean, that's easily accomplished in the cerebellum, because even though it's fairly small compared to the cerebrum, the cerebellum has most of the neurons of the overall brain. They're packed in there pretty tightly. But it also, of course, has to eventually get to the cerebral cortex. And notice that on its way, as you would expect for non-olfactory sensory information, it makes its way through the thalamus along the way. All right, that brings us to vision. Slide 31 gives you some basic anatomy. I'm not going to get bogged down in the anatomy, but I do want you to realize that the pupil, which is usually listed as a structure, is not really a structure. It's just a hole in this ring of muscle called the iris. The iris is the part that has your eye color, and that's not just for beauty. The pigments in the iris, like any pigment, what is a pigment? A pigment is something that is able to absorb at least some frequency of light. And so it keeps damaging light from entering your eye by absorbing those photons. But some photons, of course, have to pass through to the retina. Otherwise, you wouldn't have any visual perception. And that's what the pupil is. It's simply a hole. It's analogous on a camera to the aperture, which is also adjusted on a camera by the f-stop. In us, the iris is autonomically controlled to either dilate the pupil, make it bigger, or to constrict the pupil. And that's because the iris is actually two types of smooth muscle. It's arranged. There's one part of the iris that's arranged circumferentially. The grain of the muscle is like a sphincter. In fact, it's called the sphincter pupillae. But when it contracts, that makes because of the circumferential grain, it makes the hole smaller. There's an outer ring that has radially arranged grain, so that when it contracts, it stretches it outward and contracts it outward and therefore makes the pupil bigger. So let's look at the details inside. Slide 32 gives you a median view of an eyeball, and the very front of the eyeball, which is amazingly transparent for something that is living tissue, is called the cornea. It is basically the same material as the white sclera, which means that it's tough stuff. The cornea is transparent, the sclera is not, but they're both amazingly tough stuff. When you hear that you can't do certain things as a kid because you might put an eye out, it's actually fairly hard to put an eye out. If you've ever dissected an eye, it takes some pressure to poke through that thing, even with scissors, intentionally trying to. But anyway, the cornea, notice, is bulged outward in the front compared to the rest of the eyeball. It's not just a sphere. It's a sphere with a different... the overall eyeball is a sphere, but the cornea has a different curvature to it. And that's important, that curvature is important, because for terrestrial animals, which we are examples of, the cornea does most of the focusing. Now, you might think that the lens does most of the focusing because it's a lens, after all. Well, the lens certainly does do some focusing, but it does the fine adjustment. The cornea is a fixed focus device. It doesn't change. We don't change the curvature of our cornea to adjust our focus. But most of the focusing occurs there because focusing involves refraction. Refraction of light waves, light rays. What is refraction? It's simply the bending of light rays that occurs when those light rays hit an interface between two different media of different density. So for terrestrial animals, the medium in which we live, our milieu, is gas, it's air, right? So light rays are traveling through gas, and then they suddenly strike the cornea, which is the consistency pretty much of water, much more dense than air. When a light ray, when it strikes, goes from less dense to more dense, if it hits at any angle other than 90 degrees, it's going to be bent by that denser medium. Or if it goes from more dense to less dense, it'll bend as well. In other words, whenever a light ray travels from one density to another density, it gets bent or refracted. That's the basis of focusing, because light rays are fairly parallel when they hit the cornea. They need to be bent so that they focus at the retina. All right. Most of that is done at the cornea because the amount of refraction that occurs, whether it's in the eye or in a pane of glass or whatever, the amount of refraction, the degree of the bending, is a function of the difference in density of the two media. And for terrestrial animals, there is a hell of a difference between the density of the air and the density of the eye. Whereas on a fish, which lives in water, it's roughly the same density between its milieu, water, and its cornea, which is also pretty much water. So the cornea doesn't do very much bending or focusing for a fish. Almost all of that focusing is done by its lens. For us, most of the bending occurs at the cornea, but not everything is going to be in focus if there's no adjustment made. So the lens is what adjusts the focus. And the lens adjusts the focus because the lens itself is able to change its thickness. All right? The thickness of a lens, the curvature of a lens, affects the amount of refraction. How does the lens do this? Well, if the lens is cut out of an eyeball, a freshly killed eyeball, not a preserved one, it is a semi-solid mass, also amazingly transparent. They're not transparent when you dissect a sheep eye because it's been clouded by the preservative. But in a freshly killed eye, that lens, if you drop it in a glass of water, you won't see it. Anyway, it's a semi-solid sphere, more or less. When you release all the forces from it by taking it out of the eyeball, it rebounds into a pretty much spherical shape, which is thick from front to back. All right? The thicker it is from front to back, meaning along the travel of the light rays, the thicker it is, the more bending it accomplishes, the more it refracts the light. Well, that is an appropriate situation if you're trying to focus on something that's close to your eyes. Because something that's close to the eyes, the light rays are coming to my eye divergently, and they need to be really turned around and converged to reach my retina. Whereas something that's farther away, that cone of light rays are much more parallel, and they need to be bent as much to focus on the retina. So you need a different amount of refraction for each different distance that you're trying to look at. That automatic change in the thickness of the lens that accomplishes the fine focusing in response to changing the distance of viewing is called accommodation. And the lens accomplishes accommodation because it's able to change thickness since it's connected to what are called suspensory ligaments. Now the suspensory ligaments, do I have a good picture of those? No, I don't. Oh yeah, I do. Let me jump to slide 36. The suspensory ligaments are little hair-like ropes, tiny little things, that hold the lens in place, that suspend the lens. That's why they're called suspensory ligaments. But they occur just along the edge of the lens in a circle, just in one plane that is at right angles to the direction of travel. So if in my eye, as it's situated right here, my suspensory ligaments are around my lens in this direction, okay? As shown right there, part A of 36. The suspensory ligaments are directly attached to the lens at one end. At the other end of the suspensory ligament, each suspensory ligament is connected to a ring of muscle called the ciliary muscle. And that ciliary muscle is a sphincter, meaning that if it contracts, the ring gets smaller. Okay? Now this is kind of confusing to people because it seems opposite of what you'd think. The lens needs to be thick if you're trying to focus on something close up because you need a lot of refraction to occur. Well, the lens wants to be thick in a sense. The only thing keeping it from being thick is that it's being pulled on by these suspensory ligaments, which flattens it out because it pulls it out toward the edges of the eyeball. Okay, that flattens it with respect to the travel of light. What makes those suspensory ligaments pull? Well, they're not muscles. They're just passive ropes. But they're going to pull on the lens if the ciliary muscle is farther away from the lens. Okay? In other words, if the ciliary muscle, now I'm doing it in this direction, this is the ciliary muscle, if it's a bigger ring, then all of those little suspensory ligaments are going to be pulled toward the edge of the eyeball. But since they don't stretch, that means they're going to then pull on the lens, which flattens the lens out from front to back. Well, what seems opposite in people's head is that occurs when the ciliary muscle relaxes. Okay? So your lens is thin when your ciliary muscle is relaxed because the relaxation of the ciliary muscle makes it a big ring. When you use energy to contract your ciliary muscle, the ring gets smaller. That puts slack in all of those suspensory ligaments, and that allows the lens to resume its more natural shape, which makes it thicker from front to back. All right, now, I just told you that you need a thicker lens when you're trying to look at something close up, like reading. And this is exactly why reading continuously without taking a break is tiring to your eyes, because you have to continuously contract your ciliary muscles to keep enough slack in your suspensory ligaments to allow your lens to rebound to a thick enough shape to sufficiently refract the light rays to be focused on your retina. Whereas if you're looking off to the distance, your ciliary muscle is relaxed. But when the ciliary muscle is relaxed, that's pulling on the lens, making it thinner, which is appropriate for long distance viewing. All right? So lens flattened in part B is for long distance viewing. That's ciliary muscles relaxed, as shown in 36. Let me go back and make sure I didn't miss anything I want to cover on the rest of this. That's the major anatomy that I want you to know. Of course, looking at 32, of course, the optic nerve travels from the back of the eyeball a little bit medially on its way to the brain. Doesn't go just straight back. Travels medially because the two optic nerves cross before they hit the brain at what is called the optic chiasma. Chiasma means cross. But the optic nerve is just a bundle of neurons. Those individual neurons that eventually become part of the optic nerve are housed in the retina, which is the photosensitive layer of the interior of the eyeball. And that's what you see in part B of 32. That's a look at the retina. By the way, the fovea of the retina is where you have the highest concentration of the photoreceptive cells. Those photoreceptive cells are called rods and cones, and they are scattered throughout the retina, but not at the same density of scattering. There's a much greater, denser clustering of them at the fovea, and that's because the fovea is the part of the retina at which light strikes that is coming from something that you're looking directly at. Which is why when you really want to have detail, the highest level of detail, the sharpest visual acuity, you look directly at something. That forces the light that's reflected off of that object to hit your fovea, where you have much greater resolution. It's just like pixels in a CCD camera, of a digital camera. The more pixels there are, the higher the resolution there is. Well, the more rods and cones there are, the higher the resolution, and that resolution is not consistent over the retina. It's higher at the fovea. All right. Now, what's the difference, by the way, between rods and cones? Rods do not give the brain color information. Rather, they give it information about shades of gray. Cones do give color information. So there's the reason there are three primary colors is as we call them is because we have cones for redness, cones for blueness, and cones for greenness. Those are the three primary colors. You can make any color out of a combination of those, but there are different kinds of cones because there are different because they respond differently to frequencies of light. Cones give the brain color information. Well, you'd think, why not just have nothing but cones, because it's valuable to have color information. The answer is that the advantage of rods is that they are stimulated much more easily. In other words, it takes much less light to be sufficient to fire a rod than it does to fire a cone. So there's a trade-off for both. Rods give you information in very low light situations, allows for vision in low light situations, but it doesn't give you the color information. Cones give you the color information, which is valuable, but it takes more light to do it. That optic disc, by the way, I'll get to you in just a second. This optic disc is another place on the retina. This is where all the fibers or the axons of these neurons that will eventually be bundled into the optic nerve, that's where they all meet coming from different places on the retina, which correspond to different rods and cones. They all have to meet at one place in order to become part of a nerve. At that place, the optic disc, there's just so many axon fibers located right there that there's no room for any rods or cones. And therefore, even though light, of course, strikes that blind spot, as it's called, at the optic disc, since there's no photoreceptors there, there is no information no action potentials that are started there. And it's a blind spot because light hitting there doesn't let itself be known to the brain. The very cool thing, though, is that despite having a blind spot, the brain compares all the stuff that's happening around that blind spot and makes a calculation as to what should be there. It basically assumes that if you have the same kind of stuff right around the blind spot, it's a good bet that blind spot light is of the same quality. And so it creates the perception, it fills in the hole, basically. You don't have a black spot in each of your images. You actually do, but your brain is filling in that black spot with information it's assuming based on processing the surrounding information.
Back to the focus of college.
Yeah.
Were you saying that it has a high density for both rods and cones? Because I was under the impression it was different.
Well, the fovea centralis is, it's kind of, the fovea, the area of the fovea is kind of like an archery target. And so the very center of it is nothing but cones, like you say, and very high density of cones. And then a ring around that, like an archery target, is a very high density of just rods. And then there's a mixture from there on out. And that's, I'm glad you brought that up, because this is why you have such good color acuity when you look directly at something. That forces it right onto the center. But if you're looking at a night sky in a non-urban place where you can actually see a bunch of stars, so you have to get out, way out, and the moon has to be not, a new moon would be ideal situation. So you see a lot of stars, but maybe you've noticed that when you look at directly at them, they seem to kind of get fainter. And if you try to, if there's enough stars, there's going to be one right next to it. And what you might have known by accident is that if you divert your gaze a little bit to the right, the star that you used to be looking directly at gets a little bit clearer. And that's because starlight isn't very many photons. It's not enough photons to activate very many cones if you look directly at it. But if you look slightly to the right or to the left of a star, it's going to force the light that's coming from that star to be put into that area where there's a hell of a lot of rods, which are very sensitive to low levels of photons, and it brings it into clarity. Okay. 33 gives you a good look of the optic at the optic chiasm, and notice that when you're looking at the interior, these neurons that are making up the nerves, that it's much like the auditory situation. Some neurons travel ipsilaterally, some travel contralaterally, and so they're perceptually, there's a mixture of the images of the two eyeballs. And you need two eyes to have true stereo optic vision, which is what gives you information about depth. If you lose an eye, it's hard to tell how close or far things are away from you. Amazingly, your brain somehow makes up for it. You don't ever regain your true depth perception, but you can get better at it by learning, and that's probably by comparing the size of things. But the stereo-optic vision works because when you look at something, you move your eyeballs so that they're both pointed toward that object, and so your eyeballs converge more or less depending on how close that you're looking at something. If you're looking at something far away, like if I'm looking at this chair, which is about roughly halfway from here to the wall, my eyeballs have not very much convergence, right? And so if you think about just my right eye, the background on the wall for that is going to correspond to the line going from my eyeball in the direction the eyeball is pointed through the chair to the wall. The other one's going to have a slightly different background because it's pointed in a different direction. And that's why if you close one eye, if you look through a hole, for instance, make a hole in your hands, and you close one eye and then close the other, you'll see a different background because your eyes are pointing to different places at the far end. Whereas if I'm looking at closer up, my eyes are going to be converged more. That's going to be even more of a difference in the background. The background's going to be farther displaced from my two eyes. Well, the brain makes use of that by comparing the backgrounds of the images from each eye. It makes the calculation about how far those things must be. The less difference there is in the background between the two eyes, the closer that background is to the thing you're looking at. And so it gives you depth perception, stereo-optic vision. I don't want to really spend any time on slide 34. It's just showing you different refraction ways. Different lenses work by refracting light in different ways, but that's, I don't want to get into that really because I'm not going to talk about abnormalities. So 35 I'm not going to talk about either. I've already talked about 36. 37, hyperopia and myopia, I'm not going to get into the abnormalities. Although we are, as a species, becoming more and more myopic, more and more nearsighted as time goes, for some unknown reason. 38 just gives you a quick rundown, if you don't already know this, about what light is. Light is electromagnetic radiation. And the word light is used differently by different people. Some people say that light is just the visual portion of the overall electromagnetic spectrum. Some people call X-rays light, for instance, on the other hand. But in any case, this electromagnetic spectrum, all the way from radio waves, which have very long wavelengths and low energy, up to gamma rays, which have very short wavelengths and high energy. Short wavelengths means high frequency. Long wavelengths means low frequency. It's all the same stuff. The only difference about this is all the same kind of energy. It's all electromagnetic energy. The only difference is in the wavelength or frequency. So what makes light is not something that's special about that electromagnetic radiation. It just happens to be electromagnetic radiation of the correct frequencies that allows it to interact with our rods and cones and cause us to eventually have the perception of sight. But it could work just as easily with different eyes at these other frequencies because it's essentially the same stuff. It's all electromagnetic radiation. Notice, though, also that visible light is really just a tiny portion of the electromagnetic spectrum. This is probably good, though, because if we were really able to see all the electromagnetic radiation, it would be a hell of a busy image. Because we continuously have millions of radio waves and microwaves running through us all the time. If we were able to see those, it would be a confusing world. I mean, unless we had even bigger brains, I guess. Let me